Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr. and Dan Novak. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, about 42% of Argentinians live at or below the poverty rate, the government said. The rate of poverty in the nation of 45 million people has increased since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. The pandemic has also caused 3 years of deep economic recession to worsen. Eduardo David Rodriguez is one of the more than 18 million Argentinians living in poverty. He brings fruits and vegetables to sell in a market in Buenos Aires twice a week to help support his family. He lives with his wife and two of their four children in a small house outside the country's capital. There is no bathroom, running water, or fuel to cook with. Work here is tough, that's the truth, but there's no other option than to come here and bring the family back the daily bread, Rodriguez told Reuters. He said he earns about 12,000 pesos, or $60, each month. For Rodriguez and his wife, who also works, their monthly family income usually reaches around 39,000 pesos. That is well short of the poverty line for a family of four, about 67,000 pesos. Argentina is rich in natural resources, from cattle and corn to natural gas. But inflation, poor economic decision-making, and years of debt crises have severely weakened the country's economy. Sometimes we can only eat so much. We don't indulge in luxuries, but, well, thank God we don't starve, said Rodriguez's wife, Maria. She works in the family's neighborhood, clearing storm drains, which carry water away from the streets. Sometimes we have enough, and sometimes not. In his free time, Rodriguez teaches football, the sport called soccer in the United States, to children from other poor homes. He works to support their hopes of a professional career in the sport as an escape from poverty. I love being with the boys, and I come to do it without any obligation and without any salary. I do it from passion, because the truth is, this is what keeps me going every day, Rodriguez said.
Japan's Princess Mako and the man she wants to be her husband are expected to get married this month. Wedding ceremonies, however, are not planned. The marriage of Princess Mako and Kei Komuro is not fully supported by the public. Palace officials say that is because of a financial controversy involving her future mother-in-law, The controversy involving Komuro's mother is a difficult issue for the imperial family. It has led to a public rebuke that has delayed their marriage for more than 3 years. Komuro returned to Japan recently from New York. He was studying to become a lawyer in the city. He grew his hair long and tied it in a ponytail. That is considered unusual for someone marrying a princess because the Japanese imperial family is bound by tradition. His appearance only added to the criticism. The two are to register their marriage on October 26th. The Imperial Household Agency said they also will hold a news conference together at that time. The two are expected to start a new life together in New York later this year. The agency said there will be no wedding celebration or other rituals for the couple because their marriage is not celebrated by many people. Palace officials said Mako has also decided not to take a $1.35 million payment she has the right to receive for leaving the imperial family. Mako would be the first female imperial family member since World War II not to receive the payment when marrying a commoner or a person who is not a part of royalty. The agency said Mako was recently believed to have a mental condition that palace doctors described as a form of traumatic stress disorder. That condition is said to be caused by extreme mental tension. Mako turns 30 3 days before the wedding. She is a niece of Japan's Emperor Naruhito. She and Komuro were classmates at Tokyo's International Christian University when they announced in September 2017 that they wanted to marry the following year. But the financial controversy surfaced 2 months later. The wedding was suspended. The controversy involved money Komuro's mother received from a man she was to marry. It is not clear whether that money, which was spent on Komuro's education in Japan, was a loan or a gift. Komuro left for New York in 2018 to study law. He did not return to Japan until last week. The Imperial House law only permits males to carry forward the line of emperors. Female members of the royal family must give up their royal position when they marry a commoner. This rule has resulted in a decrease in the size of the royal family and a shortage of possible successors to the throne. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Swiss researchers say they have completed the most detailed virtual reality map of the universe ever created. The map permits users to travel through space and time, the researchers said in a recent statement. It can be imagined as a kind of Google Earth, but for the universe. The map was created by a team at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne. With the help of VR headsets, users can visit places in the universe virtually. This includes the International Space Station, the Moon, Saturn, and faraway exoplanets. The software program is called the Virtual Reality Universe Project, or VRUP. The researchers said they combined the largest data set of information about the universe to create the three-dimensional experience. People can see the virtual universe through VR equipment or with 3D glasses in a theater. A personal computer can also be used to see the universe in a non-3D way. Jean-Paul Kneipp is the director of EPFL's Astrophysics Laboratory. He told the Associated Press one of the best parts of the project was putting together parts of the data set into one framework. You can see the universe at different scales, nearby us, around the Earth, around the solar system, at the Milky Way level, Kneipp said. To see through the universe and time up to the beginning, what we call the Big Bang. Many scientists believe the Big Bang is the explosion that created the universe. VRUP produces images that can appear as close as 1 meter or seemingly at an infinite distance. It is available to everyone for free, but does require at least a computer and is best experienced with VR equipment that can also show 3D images. It aims to get many kinds of visitors. This includes both scientists looking to get a virtual picture of the data they collect and people seeking a new way to explore the universe. The software has been released in its first or beta version. This version can run on personal computers, but not Mac computers from Apple. Downloading the software and content can be difficult for less skilled computer users. Users seeking the best experience will also need a powerful computer with a lot of storage. There are different versions of the software. A smaller version is aimed at the public, and a larger one is meant for scientists or astronomy experts. The project combines information from 8 databases. It includes at least 4,500 known exoplanets, tens of millions of galaxies, and hundreds of millions of space objects. More than 1.5 billion light-producing objects from the Milky Way alone are included. The researchers expect to continually add data, meaning the virtual experience will keep getting better with time.
I'm Brian Lynn.
To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus,
Wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int, or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. 1852 was a presidential election year in the United States. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention in Baltimore, Maryland. The meeting opened in June of 1852. Delegates agreed that a man must win two-thirds of the convention's votes to be the Democratic candidate. On the first ballot, no one received two-thirds of the vote, so the voting continued. Finally, on the 47th ballot, support began to increase for someone considered an unlikely candidate. His name was Franklin Pierce. Pierce was from the northeastern state of New Hampshire. He was a lawyer and former state lawmaker. He also had served in the United States Senate and House of Representatives. He became an officer in the Army during the U.S. war with Mexico. On the 49th ballot, Pierce won the Democratic nomination. He would be the party's candidate for president.
Pierce was a passionately loyal adherent of the Democratic Party and of its principles of negative governance domestically and spread eagle expansionism in foreign affairs.
Historian Michael Holt wrote a book about Franklin Pierce. Mr. Holt describes Pierce as someone who was like most Democrats at the time. In other words, he did not think the federal government should intervene much in efforts to help build up and develop the nation. But he wanted the United States to play a big and powerful role internationally. Naturally, Democrats did not agree on every policy issue. In 1852, the party was sharply divided on whether the government should or could permit slavery to continue in the United States. But Democrats decided to limit their fighting with each other during the election campaign, and they all agreed to support Pierce. The Whig Party held its presidential nominating convention in Baltimore 2 weeks after the Democrats met. The same thing that happened at the Democratic convention now happened at the Whig convention. Delegates voted over and over again, but no man got enough votes to win. It took 53 ballots before one of the men, General Winfield Scott, won the nomination. On election day, Pierce won a crushing victory. The Democrats won not only the presidency, but also strong majorities in Congress. The Democrats' victory was so great that many people thought the Whig Party was finished. In fact, many Whigs themselves hoped their party was destroyed. Like the Democrats, Whigs disagreed with each other about slavery. Northern Whigs wanted to form a new anti-slavery party, and Southern Whigs wanted to form a party that would better represent their interests. The Whigs lost badly in the 1852 elections because, unlike the Democrats, they were not able to bridge the differences between their northern and southern members. Franklin Pierce was 48 years old when he took office. He was the youngest man yet to be elected president. He was charming and made friends easily, but those who knew Pierce best worried about him. They knew that under all his friendly charm, he was a weak man. They feared the duties and problems of the presidency would be too great for him to deal with. Pierce also faced a difficult situation in his personal life. Two of his children had died when they were babies. A third child was killed in a train accident shortly before Pierce moved to the White House. In addition, his wife, Jane, did not like living in Washington, D.C. She did not support her husband's campaign for presidency. Years earlier, she had urged him to resign from the Senate and return to New Hampshire. She did not want to go back to Washington. When her husband was elected, she agreed to live there, but she rarely saw anyone. One of her close friends took her place at public events. Historian Michael Holt says Franklin Pierce's main goal as president was to keep his party united. One way to maintain party unity was to adopt popular democratic policies. He promised strong support for expanding the territory of the United States. He also promised a strong foreign policy. During his term in office, Pierce successfully negotiated with Britain to gain American fishing rights along the coast of Canada. He also supported diplomatic and trade talks with Japan. However, he was unsuccessful in an attempt to buy Cuba from Spain. National issues presented President Pierce with a more difficult problem. Now that the election was over, some Democrats felt it was time once again to raise the issue of slavery. The Compromise of 1850 had settled the question of slavery only in the Western territories. But anti-slavery activists said the compromise should have done more to end slavery throughout the country. And pro-slavery activists said the agreement did not protect slave owners' rights. They did not want the federal government to intervene in slavery anywhere. As president in 1853, Pierce had to choose between the competing sides. He could support the Compromise of 1850 and say the dispute over slavery was settled. Or Pierce could try to make peace with both anti- and pro-slavery extremists. Giving the extremists jobs in his administration would be the easy way to satisfy their demands. And that was the policy Pierce chose.
Contemporaries at the time predicted that this attempt to share the plums would wreck the party, and it did.
Historian Michael Holt says Pierce sought to include men from competing sides of the Democratic Party in his cabinet. Pierce named William Marcy of New York as Secretary of State. Marcy wanted to limit the spread of slavery and keep the Union together. Jefferson Davis of Mississippi was named Secretary of War. Davis, more than any other man, represented Southern slave owners. He threatened to take the South out of the Union if the government set any limits on slavery. Caleb Cushing of Massachusetts was named Attorney General. Although a Northerner, Cushing was a friend of many Southerners. He was a very able man, but his loyalties were not clear. James Buchanan of Pennsylvania was named Minister to Britain. All these men had strong ideas about the future of the United States. President Pierce found it difficult to control them. One senator even said the administration should not have been called the Pierce administration because Pierce did not lead it. He said it was an administration of enemies of the Union who used the president's name and power for their own purposes. As president, Franklin Pierce faced another difficult question. Where should the United States build its new railroads? The country had expanded, and white settlers were moving west. Many were hungry for good transportation. They wanted railroads that reached across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. Engineers decided that 4 new rail lines would be possible. They could cross the southern, central, or northern parts of the United States. Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, a Democrat, proposed that 3 of the lines be built. He said the government could give land to the railroad companies. The companies could then sell the land to get the money they needed to build the lines. A Senate committee discussed the issue. Its members proposed that only 1 railroad line be built. But which one? Many congressmen believed a southern line would be best. There would be little snow in winter, and the railroad would cross lands that were already organized as states or official territories. A northern or central line would face severe winter weather, and it would have to cross a large, wild area called Nebraska. Nebraska was neither a state nor a territory. As a result, it did not yet have a local government that could support a railroad. In addition, many congressmen did not want Nebraska to develop a government. The reason, once again, was slavery. Michael Holt says members of President Pierce's party hoped the effort to organize Nebraska would unite Democrats once again. Instead, Mr. Holt says, the Nebraska Territory caused more conflicts and ruined Pierce's administration. The bill increased divisions between Democrats and Whigs and between pro-slavery activists and anti-slavery abolitionists. And it brought the country one step closer to civil war. As one Northerner wrote, it was said hundreds of years ago that a house divided against itself cannot stand. The truth of this saying is written on every page in history. It is likely that the history of our own country may offer fresh examples to teach this truth to future ages.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.